The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist.
You're listening to Radio Aryan.
Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor of Russian and Ukrainian history and philosophy, an Orthodox priest, and a theorist of nationalism and agrarianism. And now, here's Matt.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Today is the first day of Lent 2012. And for us in the Orthodox Church, this period of time, from now until Easter, we rededicate and renew our commitment to Christ and the Church. And we do this through fasting and abstinence from all pleasures, especially social pleasures. And we do this not because suffering is somehow worthwhile in its own right, but that in depriving ourselves of these social distractions, we can more focus on our relationship with God, but just as important, the order or disorder, as it were, of our souls. The whole point of fasting, and I get this question quite often, the point of fasting is to liberate those elements of your being that can be weighed down with heavy foods. When you eat a heavy meal, the first thing you want to do is go to sleep. When you fast, your body begins cleansing itself. It begins consuming any small tumors or rashes or anything else. The body will go into a new mode of action where it begins to consume all of these harmful elements and chemicals within the body. The difference between fasting and starvation is that when you're fasting, the body is consuming all of the negative chemicals and tissues in your system. These are unhealthy cells. Starvation is when your body is forced to consume healthy cells to survive. So that's the difference. The point is that when you fast, more oxygen gets to your brain. It makes you more alert. It makes you sharper. It makes you more focused. And so when you pray and you read, you're far more focused than you would be if you were eating and drinking in a normal way. So that's the point of fasting. And certainly pagans and other peoples have done it long before Christ was around. And in the polis system of ancient Athens and in Greece in general, no major decision was ever taken without fasting. All major decisions usually were preceded by a fast of usually a week or so. And the point is that your mind gets sharper, toxins get consumed, and therefore you are more rational, and the spirit, so to speak, is liberated from slavery to the body. Okay, but you know, for those of us who are Russian Orthodox medievalists and traditionalists and all that, our whole life is one big Lent, living under the New World Order. And there's somebody I want to deal with today that I have so much stuff on, I don't think I could ever get to it all. But the rather famous Metropolitan John Snechev of St. Petersburg, who died in 1995. Metropolitan John actually served within the Soviet Patriarchate. He was, of course, vehemently anti-communist. But the Soviet Union, at the time of his elevation to bishop, wanted to put forth a much different image to the West. And so Metropolitan John was, for the most part, given a certain freedom of action. But especially when the Soviet Union began to crumble in the late 80s, he became more militant in his condemnations of the Soviet system. And he is one of the great 20th century theologians of Russia, and he dies November 2nd, 1995. Now, I've read his collected works in Russian. I don't know what of Metropolitan John's exists in English at all. Maybe nothing, but I have read some of his more major essays and sermons concerning, number one, the role of Russia, number two, the role of the Jews, and number three, the role of the New World Order, or Antichrist, which he considers to be one and the same thing. The solution to the evil of the New World Order is for the Russian church to go back to its sense of subordinost, the sense of conciliar activity, where all major decisions are done with the consent of the whole church, and where the church is not considered as an organization, but it is considered an organism. It's vivified by the Spirit, it is purified by Christ's sacrifice on the cross, and then it presents itself to God the Father for the expiation of all of our sins. But the point of it is, he does not want to glorify the bureaucracy or the hierarchy. Hierarchy is there as a matter of service. They do not differ from the layman or the average monk in any kind of spiritual way. It's just that their functions are different within the organism. Metropolitan John was one of these guys who believed that Russia was a specific chosen people. A specific chosen people that had one mission, and that is to stand fast for Christianity against the New World Order. As the Western churches overwhelmingly fall away, as they get involved in trendy liberalism and everything else, it seems that Russia remains. And the very fact that it could produce a Metropolitan John who defied the Soviet system, but then eventually oversaw its destruction in the early 1990s. Russian history, in his mind, is a constant battle. He sees the Bolshevik Revolution as the purging of the Russian church, the exile, a purging of the parishes and the monasteries, so only the best and highest quality people will stay. People aren't going to church for some social reason. They're going to church because they love the Trinity, and they're risking their life in order to do that. And he sees, really, the entire 20th century, the Russian history of being one huge purge of the more corrupt elements of that society. He refuses, however, and this is very significant, he refuses to hold that being Russian is somehow an ethnic connection. So the Bolshevik leaders who may be Russian ethnically are certainly not Russian in the broader traditional sense of the word. They may have a Russian last name, they may speak Russian fluently, but it doesn't make them a Russian. The one thing that makes somebody a Russian is their adherence to the Orthodox faith. It's sort of like saying that if you're Roman Catholic, you therefore must be Italian or live in Rome. That doesn't make any sense. Anyone could be a Roman Catholic. But in Metropolitan John's idea, anyone could be Russian Orthodox. What makes a Russian is not your last name, but it is the faith and the love and devotion to the tradition. Russian history is, to a great extent, the development of the family, the development of the familial ideal from the commune to the synod, and then from the time of troubles right up until 1988, where the Soviet Union began to totter. This is the constant, lengthy purification of Russia. And now after the Soviet Union, he's writing now in the early 1990s, the end of the Soviet Union in his mind is the concept of rebuilding and rebuilding the Russian nation on the basis of the ancient tradition. And he shares that point of view with Solzhenitsyn and many others. He views ecumenism and syncretism to be ultimately a Jewish elitist concept. And he was extremely vociferous in this particular condemnation. He was a militant Orthodox person. He rejected all forms of timidity and passivity. We turn the other cheek to our brethren, because we may not fight and continue to argue with other Orthodox people. We respect each other's opinions so long as it's not heretical, and we turn the other cheek if they will ever assault. But that's another matter. Saying you turn the other cheek to the enemies of the church is out of the question. And Metropolitan John condemns this concept of passivity. And what he wants in its place is really the militancy of daily life. That you could do a lot just in your own neighborhood. And the family and the extension of that family or the village, which is the parish, these are the central cells of the church. They are not the playthings of the hierarchy. They are integral institutions that can convert many if their life is healthy. fighting the enemies of Russia and of the Russian church is something commanded by the ancient tradition. It is certainly present in the Old Testament, and it's something that Christ did not reject, especially when his church was under constant attack. The point of it all is that government, whether church or state or both, is social harmony. Its foundation is peace, but peace in a very specific way. Peace where all of the pieces and elements of society do its own work without much mutual interference. Politics is about service. It's a perversion that politics somehow has become about power. It isn't. It's about service to the broader general will of the Russian people or any group of people. Power is about service. It is not good in its own sake. And he sees the Russian monarchy as the perfect example of the unity of the elites on the one hand and the peasants and townsmen on the other. And the point is a sort of a non-ideological approach to politics that allows the state to create a modicum of peace and virtue and to punish those that would do damage to the church. But all of this, ultimately, he sees as a religious institution. He says you can't study monarchy unless you fully understand the Orthodox tradition, its canons, and how the saints, both Old and New Testament, have understood the concept of monarchy. Sometimes I get the question, why didn't Christ put out a political theory? He had nothing of the kind, not an economic theory, not a political theory. And the reason is very simple, because he's preaching to an audience who already knew the Old Testament and knew it fairly well. I know I said this before, but it's very significant. The prophets laid out a very useful, very virtuous concept of social and political theory and economics. And reading the prophets has to precede the understanding of Christ. You have to know what the prophets said and how they operated, and then see how Christ is the final expression of that prophetic ideal. But the prophets, without exception, had a very tightly integrated concept of economics and political theory, and Christ said nothing to overthrow this. He simply assumed that his hearers understood what was happening. But the point is that he sees the Russian nation as a chosen people, as a new Israel, as the Third Rome. And it's not an ethnic or a racial mark at all. It has to do with the devotion to the church and the monastic life. Even as a layman, we're still called to that. And its primary ingredient is subordinus. We've dealt with that on this show many times. Subordinus is this idea that any major decision, and even the day-to-day functions of the church body, have to bring in all elements. It is not just the hierarchy that then dictates. The church is seen as an organism that is vivified by the presence of the Holy Spirit. Becoming a bishop or a priest does not guarantee you an extra amount of that grace. There is a single uncreated presence of logos. And in many cases, when the bishops fall away, when the bishops become corrupt, it is the average layman who then takes over. This was the case in Ukraine at the beginning of the 17th century, where it was the brotherhoods, not the bishops, not the priests, it was the brotherhoods that were empowered by the Patriarch of Jerusalem at the time. Theophanes III, we've dealt with him on this show before, has permitted and gave canonical standing to the brotherhoods. That's not a new theological idea, although sometimes it gets overlooked. The concept is that this sort of general will, where all elements of the church come and see themselves in canon law and in the liturgy, only distinct in terms of function in the church, but that's it. There is no hierarchy in the sense that a bishop is superior to a priest. Bishops themselves are products of the monastic life, and hence, if anything, the monastic life becomes the form, in the Platonic sense, of what a Christian is supposed to be, especially in times of the New World Order, where the hostility to any form of ethnic nationalism and religious tradition is under vicious attack. But he continues. He notices something. You're from Eastern Europe, and you have lived under Marxism. Then you have seen your work and your savings completely destroyed and liquidated by the oligarchs under the so-called democratic regime and protected by the United States and the major bankers. Metropolitan John says that there's something here. There's the average Russian, not only, of course, is vehemently anti-Soviet, but is also vehemently anti-capitalist and anti-liberal in the broad sense of the word. So Metropolitan John sees that, you know, he's writing in 93, 94, that Russia can be the very core and center of the resistance to the New World Order because the average educated Russian knows how wicked the Soviet system was, but also knows how wicked the capitalist and so-called liberal democratic tradition is in Russia. Therefore, if there's any place in the world that's going to enjoy that third way, that nationalist, royalist, Christian socialist, and agrarian concept, the distributivist concept, it will be Russians, because they do not trust the old Soviet system. They also do not trust liberal democracy and this BS end-of-history stuff coming from American academics. Russia is the center of resistance to the New World Order. The Russian church is central to the resistance of the New World Order. It is essentially one and the same organization. And any of us who join in that fight, and even if they are, you know, under the Serbs, under the Greeks, whatever it is, it really doesn't matter. The one thing is that the faith matters. And because of Russia's size, her educated population, her natural resources, and her long history of bravery against impossible odds, Russia is the ultimate central battlement against the New World Order. And this is very popular on the monks of the late 19th century in Russia, etc. The concept that Russia is specifically called, given its geographical situation, to be the main center of power against the New World Order. He has four general points when he deals with the concept of Russian history. You know, he sees the early 90s, obviously, as a time of immense change. But he defines what Russian history really is with one variable in mind, and that is the constant warfare, both intellectual and physical, of the Russian Orthodox tradition and the agrarian monastic life on the one hand, and constant attempts to subvert and destroy it on the other, and that includes both internal and external forces. A friend of mine wrote me not too long ago and said, you know, when I found out that around the very beginning of the 20th century in Russia under the Tsars, that they discovered oil in the Caucasus, that Russia was then slated for destruction. Russia was growing in population by leaps and bounds. The Tsar was insisting on the colonization of Siberia and giving peasants free land, free implements, free seed, and tax-free status for however long, so that they could colonize Siberia. The Russian nation would be this massive entity, rapidly industrializing with now massive amounts of oil in the southern part of the country to increase her wealth. The British Rothschilds panicked. And in their panic, they built up the Japanese Imperial Navy as well as any other internal revolutionary group inside Russia to overthrow the Tsar. Given the very high trade surplus, budget surplus of the Russian crown, and the increase in population, and then the rapid industrialization, and finally the discovery of oil in the Caucasus, Russia was on its way to becoming the only superpower on the planet. And this is what forced the hand of the Rothschilds in Russian history. And many of the, like Alexander Herzen, was given a large amount of money by the Rothschild family and sent him back to Russia. But the four points are this. Number one, Russia is constantly at war. That doesn't mean that it's constantly shooting, but it means that the intellectual battle, the physical battle, the battle for Russian resources and the educated elite in Russia, this is a constant field of battle. Number two, Russian wars were overwhelmingly defensive. Either it was against Lithuanian expansion, Polish expansion, Swedish expansion, Turkish expansion, the Mongols. It has always been a defensive posture that the Russian nation has maintained over the centuries. But thirdly, the whole concept of the cultural Russian Orthodox man develops from this constant warfare. Now, it creates a citizen, a person of tremendous militancy and distrust of outsiders. And finally, people forget this, and that in the early years of the very beginning of the Russian Empire, Turkish organizations, tribes from the southern part of the southwestern part of the country enslaved hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Russians and sold them in the slave mart of the Middle East, Kaffa, Black Sea, etc. And so the concept of Russia being considered just a land of cheap slaves is something that typified Russian history, especially in its early centuries. But all of this taken together creates a very powerful ethnos. All of these struggles come to create a unified Russian people. And I have defined nationalism on this show in a different way than anyone else, and that is that it's struggles of a people, internal battles, external warfare, defensiveness. This builds institutions and ways of thinking that deepen the connection of this particular group. It becomes a nation, and it becomes a nation because it has suffered together. Okay, we're going to stop here. We will take a break. When we come back, we're going to deal with the increasingly specific and militant social philosophy of Metropolitan John. We'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there is more on the Orthodox Nationalist. This is VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. Let's return to the Orthodox Nationalist, hosted by Matt Johnson.
Okay, everyone, welcome back. We are talking about the rather famous Metropolitan John of St. Petersburg, who dies in 1995, and so served in the church both under the Soviet system and under the post-Soviet capitalist and so-called democratic system. That puts him in a very interesting position, because he sees both sides of that coin as essentially one thing. It's materialist, it loathes any concept of family or tradition, certainly nation, and the self-sacrifice and the socialism that both the prophets and the church fathers had laid out as the necessary economic system of any Christian society. He sees the early 90s as a time of renewal, but that there has been a tremendous amount of force by the forces of Yeltsin and Harvard University and the American State Department and the World Bank to take over and to slowly liquidate the Russian economy. I don't think a lot of people recognize just how horrible things were in Russia in the early 1990s. Two-thirds of its economic institutions were liquidated and sent abroad. Liberal democracy was a cover for both external and internal oligarchs who use Britain and Israel as a source of funneling their ill-gotten money. So Metropolitan John, like Solzhenitsyn at the time, knows both sides of the coin, but then claims that advanced democratic capitalism and advanced authoritarian socialism are one and the same. The institutions may differ, but the goal, the materialist production and technocracy, is identical in all cases. He says that the CIA, the major banks, sent Protestant evangelists into Russia specifically to teach them the capitalist ethos and to teach them to be a part of the New World Society. And his constant battles with Protestant and a handful of Catholic evangelicals in Russia, he sees as a Western intelligence operation to propagandize the Russian people. Putin remains, as of today, leap year, February 29th, immensely popular. And he's immensely popular because he rejected this new world assault on Russian enterprise. And Metropolitan John saw the Protestant evangelicals and the so-called Christian Zionists, which of course is a contradiction in terms, as being sent into Russia to prepare the average Russian person to understand Western dominance and the invasion of Western capital. And they had to do this under a liberal democratic system, which weakens the state, and so that private capital then can fill that void. And that's been the case in America as well as in Russia. So he sees in his constant debates with the Protestant evangelicals, he is fairly certain that they're receiving an awful lot of money from the Central Intelligence Agency and major foundations, Ford, Rockefeller, Carnegie, in the West. For a long time, it's been common knowledge that the Dalai Lama, for example, has been on the CIA payroll with a salary of roughly $200,000 a year for his travel and everything else to help to stabilize the Chinese system. He sees that same operation being done by another religious authority, the evangelicals, who always had mountains of money and were always quite suspicious as to where it all came from. He sees Russia as really at the cusp of developing the third way, non-capitalist, non-socialist, but the great property relocation of the distributivist idea. And Christian socialism is really nothing other than that, but it is the centrality of the agrarian life, the agrarian commune, the small parish and skeet as the very central core in the cells of a new Russia. He wants to see the priority given to real production, to have the financial elite who live by manipulating the labor of others without actually producing anything at all, that these need to be tightly controlled. There's two different ways of looking at the economy. I mean, the one way is where people actually make things, including things like knowledge, you know, and understanding, but make these things that you could actually point to a real product that has value, and you gave it that value through your labor. On the other hand, it is the financial banking element that actually produces nothing, but is skilled in how to trade and profit off of the labor of others. Remember, every bit of stock that you own comes into existence only because a group of workers put their minds together to create that value. That value doesn't come from nothing. It comes from the work of labor and labor operating together cooperatively to produce that value. So the financial world is a perversion because it does not produce anything, but it takes, let's say, you know, stock or a debt or whatever it is, and trades it and makes money off it and manipulates the market for their own purposes. This is non-productive labor, and it needs to be reduced to an absolute minimum. He sees credit as a problem. The manipulation of credit markets, the manipulation of money markets, has nothing to do with the true economic basis of a society. Now, there's always higher goods than efficiency and basic production. Credit is something that should be tightly controlled by the state and focused only to real physical productive enterprise, including the old Czarist idea, which developed under Alexander III, to give interest-free loans to people who wanted to go back to the land, to assist in the development of small business and cooperatives and everything else. And like Vladimir Putin, Metropolitan John sees the best and most rational economy as one that is of mixed background, individual ownership, collective ownership, that is to say that the workers, in fact, own the stock and get to vote on various production goals, etc. State control over certain things like the strategic oil reserves and everything else, that this kind of mixture of different forms of ownership can serve as a spur to competition and to develop a strong sense of solidarity amongst the population. He sees capitalism as just as evil as socialism. And this was the case in Dostoevsky. It's also the case in Solzhenitsyn, Gogol, and so many others in Russian history, where capitalism is seen as a solvent that dissolves the ties of family and church and farmstead. It reduces everything to what, I mean, Karl Marx himself said this. It reduces all transactions, including people. It reduces them to a dollar amount. And he sees this combination of materialist socialism in the worst sense, and materialist capitalism in the worst sense, coming together in something called the New World Order, where the entire globe will be open in terms of immigration or trade. Wages will be brought to the lowest common denominator, and it's going to be corporate elites that dictate public policy, not states. New World Order ultimately is a projection of capitalism. It wants to see a single global order with complete open movement of capital and labor without any distinction in state, government, or culture, people, religion, nationality. The point, of course, is the ultimate super exploitation where workers receive the bare minimum to survive because they're competing with many in the third world, the developing world, driving labor costs down almost to an absolute minimum. And of course, that's always been my opinion about feminism, is if feminism comes at the same time as open immigration in the 60s and early 70s, where the American male was at the height of his earning power and increasingly capable of dictating terms to his superiors. Bringing in immigration and women was a way, number one, to break that solidarity, and number two, drive wages down. It's not an accident. The feminist movement develops and becomes popular precisely at the period of time where American manufacturing jobs were paying the highest. If you wanted American productivity, which blows away everybody else, you need to invest in America. And because it was only, for the most part, men working, labor costs were high. Feminism and open immigration, there's no doubt in my mind, developed at the same time and for the same reason. And it's not a coincidence that these both developed in the late 60s and early 70s, where American earning power was at its height. Since then, American earning power wages have gone down relative to all other factors. Metropolitan John says the state is significant. The state, if it's informed by the ethnic and religious idea, is an important, if not exclusive, break on this capitalist concept. Alexander Lukashenko in Belarus, one of my favorite politicians, I've been a big defender of his over the years. He is one of the most popular men in the world in terms of political leadership. And he is this way because he used the state, which was very much nationalist and ethnic in its vision, very close to the church, although not a believer himself, loves the church as a cultural and national symbol, and has a tremendous amount of, you know, poetry and liturgy that he respects, although he doesn't really, as far as I know, doesn't really believe in that stuff. Stopping privatization, building up the power of the state. It's a small country. Belarus is exposed and vulnerable. The state is that one means whereby the interests of Belarusians and Russians and Ukrainians living in that country can be protected from the predatory financiers of the West. And then he sees, I've been saying this for a long time, the ultimate Antichrist, the Antichrist that will come to rule in the last days for a relatively short period of time before Christ will intervene, that is the New World Order. He doesn't believe that the Antichrist is an actual man, a person. It is a tiny elite that act as if they are one man. The so-called Adam Kadmon idea of this completely rebuilt human world, the so-called Temple of Solomon, which is central to modernity and the killing of the king ritual and everything else. We've dealt with this on this show. The state is there to put a break on the predatory nature of Western capitalism. The New World Order is Antichrist. It functions like Antichrist. It performs in every way the great apocalyptic writings would be Isaiah, Daniel, Revelations itself. And you have to know, you have to read the apocalypse of Isaiah and Daniel. Then you read the apocalypse, because otherwise it won't make any sense. You just can't pick it up and start reading it. You have to recognize the prophetic importance of the end times and what Antichrist actually is. And it will function as one man, but it isn't one man. It's essentially a small group of institutions that desire nothing more than absolute global dominance to create a single global market and a single global source of credit. He sees primarily the Russian character as based on one thing. And this is a very common concept. People hold this view who are very different in philosophy. It's held by Dostoevsky. It's held by Berdyaev. It's held by Gogol. Russian man is typified by one central thing, the absolute obsession with tearing away the social masks that people wear in society and ideas wear to become accepted, and to expose the myth and the power underneath it. It is a constant quest for this ideal truth and a loathing for mere appearances. And this is something that Metropolitan John Berdyaev, so many others say, is very typical of the Russian soul and of the Russian mind. But this also comes from constant suffering, from constant attacks, from constant intervention of foreign powers in Russia's world. The central concept is that the notion of liberal democracy is a fraud. There's nobody out there who will put their love and trust in a procedure. They don't care about procedures. They care about who gets elected and then who that politician then owes for his power. That's the nature of democracy. It is connected to capitalism, and the concept is that all politicians, to be successful, have to get media attention, have to get positive media attention, have to get money from the elites of the society to run a successful campaign. What that means in practice is that the whole thing is a sham. It's a way that the state can be privatized and run by corporate power. The fact that a huge proportion of the Russian economy was liquidated between 1989 and 1996, 97, when the ruble just simply gave out. This is the democratic mentality. This is the concept that politicians serve the elite in the economy, and the state is not autonomous. The state becomes privatized. That's the case in most of the world. But when the state is then rearmed and centralized and militarized in certain cases, can it do battle with the New World Order? And therefore, the forms of state, I mean, Metropolitan John is a monarchist, but the big thing isn't so much the type of government, but the virtue of the population. A vicious population won't be able to function under the best of governments. They destroy it. But liberal democracy is one of the ultimate weapons that the New World Order has to dismantle the state and then to place within it politicians and bureaucrats who owe the major bankers and corporate elites in society. Metropolitan John spends a tremendous length of time on the nature of the regime. I use the word regime pretty regularly, and I mean it with a capital R. It's a technical phrase, technical word. Its definition is that set of institutions allied with one another who seek to make the New World Order a reality. So it would include media elites, government elites, academics, financial elites, even elites in entertainment, and sort of using entertainers as political propagandists. These institutions function together. They function informally. But the point is always the same: to create the destruction of all religion and ethnicity and create a cultureless world order that serves capital and the so-called demand, and the demand for goods and services being manipulated by advertising and everything else. That's the ultimate goal. The regime is this connect. You can't, in 2012, you can't separate private power from public power. State, bank, corporation, they're essentially the same thing. The state is as much a private zone as it is a public zone. The state has been privatized. The only thing that matters is its inner core of bankers and industrialists who control the flow of global capital and completely dominate labor and force all states to become dependent upon it, because it alone holds the liquidity needed for capital and hence investment. And both Putin and Lukashenko have created their own state-centered institutions of credit. I think the Islamic banking system, which now is of immense power, is another example of how the process can be reversed. So he defines the regime this way. Everything that I've said really comes from him, but of course I've been saying this for a long time. It is global. It doesn't believe in borders. It is not reduced to a certain geographical area. It is meant to be global. It is obsessed with Russia. Russia is that one piece of the puzzle that they're really struggling to break because of its size and the nationalism of the population. It's very difficult to attack. They use institutions like the World Council of Churches, which unfortunately the Patriarch of Russia is a member of, to create this religious weakness, this ecumenism, this syncretism, to mold all religions together into one just general Gnostic concept. There's something about Russia, defined the way he defines the word, that is really a thorn in the side of the regime. And you have everything from Protestant evangelicals to the Catholic Fatima people to the Bilderberg meetings, absolutely obsessed with Russia. I know I mentioned to a friend of mine that the last two Bilderberg meetings have had zero representation from Russia. Russia has been absolutely kicked out of the Bilderberg organization. I think over the last three meetings, I think there was one Russian, a name that I didn't recognize. I'm good friends with Jim Tucker, and I've worked with him against the Bilderbergs in the past. It's fascinating that in the last three or four years, not a single significant Russian has been permitted to the Bilderberg clan. And the fact is how the regime financed the Bolsheviks, invested trillions over the decades in the Soviet system, then liquidated their investments after 1990. With all of that, the concentration camps and the mass killings and the brainwashing, the destruction of the family, the destruction of any kind of solidarity whatsoever, failed to destroy the Russian idea, and it failed to destroy the church. And that is, if anything else, is one of the most significant elements of Russian politics in the 1990s. He views perestroika as the new time of troubles, the continual liquidation and looting of the work of the Russian laborer, completely liquidated and sent to the elite throughout the globe, the U.S., Britain, Israel, etc. Now, he talks quite a bit about the Jews, and he sees the Jews as being disproportionately represented in the New World Order and the regime and these institutions. He sees it as something that has to be understood spiritually. In other words, the Jews have defined themselves in their mission as negating Christianity. Their whole world is to negate Christianity. If for whatever reason Christianity were to disappear tomorrow, the Jews would start killing each other. They need that Christian enemy, and more than anything else, they need the Russian Christian enemy, and that gives them their sense of solidarity and cohesion. The two worldviews of Talmudic Judaism and the ancient Russian Orthodox tradition are complete and total polar opposites. They have nothing in common. They're two worldviews that cannot be synthesized in any honest way. One of them's going to win, and the other one is going to lose. He sees the Talmud as Judaism, not as an adjunct to Judaism, but actual Judaism itself. And he implies what I've been saying for years, that if the Jews reject the Talmud, then a new era in relations can be born. Any Jew who rejects the Talmud is a friend of mine, and I would treat him with the utmost respect. But those who accept the Talmud, we know what's in there, and we know what it says about us, and the foundation of the Jewish mentality is to define itself against Christianity. Without Christianity, Judaism would have no more function. There is this concept, though, that Russians and Jews have in common, and that is this idea of being chosen. Jews believe themselves to be a chosen people, even if they're fully atheist. The overwhelming majority of Jews are atheistic. The Russians view themselves as a chosen people because it is the Third Rome, because it is the last major battlement of true orthodoxy and the ethnic ideal which brings orthodoxy to the hut and to the house and to the apartment. So, our position here is one of constant Lenten fasting. It may not be in terms of food, but fasting from sin, from supporting the New World Order, and sort of a voluntary poverty to constantly protest the obsession with dollars and cents that the regime brings to everything it touches. There's one battle here, and that is whether or not Russia can serve as the conciliar head of Orthodox Christendom. It isn't a dictatorship, the state, or of the church. It is a single body manifested supernaturally, maintained supernaturally by the Holy Spirit. That entity and that entity alone is capable of defeating the New World Order and the Talmudic idea. We're talking about a truly reflective unity where people come to the faith and the specific Russian mission, the way Metropolitan John defines it, because they have rationally deduced its truth, not because they're born into it or whatever it is. It is a true reflective concept of unity under the faith within the idea of subordinost, or this full unity of basic concepts, language, and tradition. And that's where authority is, not the power of a specific institution, but it is internal, and it is internally understood. The famous concept of integral knowledge of Kudiski, the Slavophile movement in general, that grace is singular. It exists on earth right now, the Garden of Eden itself, and only the saints are capable of getting there because through fasting and other struggles and removing themselves from the world, have they been able to see more. They see things in nature, the presence of Logos connecting all elements of the world and society together. It is singular, but because of our passions, we only see the nominal entity, just the individual thing that we see in front of our face. They are not individual. In fact, they are part of a larger system, bringing all elements together under Logos. And as far as human beings are concerned, the family, especially the extended family, the parish and the monastery, working together, being different only in terms of their function, but not there's this hierarchy that a bishop has more grace than I do. That's not Christianity. Grace is something that exists in its fullness right now, and the church is the external coding that points, as a symbol does. A symbol points to the reality underneath it. And that's exactly what the church does. That's what the incense does, and the prayers, and the poetry, and the icons, and everything else. It points to where that grace can be found, and you prepare yourself to enter into it through fasting and spiritual reading, and to refocus your life. You take your life apart. See all the different elements that meet together to form your personhood. Then you put them all back together, but this time with Christ and the gospel at the center. That's the concept. It is a reflective unity of rational people coming together within the Orthodox idea, doing battle with the New World Order and the enemies of the Russian people. He is a nationalist. He doesn't understand people who reject nationalism on Christian grounds. I think it has more to do with the definition. The definition of nationalism that I use on this show I've already dealt with many times. The idea is the ethnic concept that derives from the solidarity that comes from suffering. That's what creates a nation, even in a family. If your family goes through a lot of hard times, it comes out of it. It comes out of it stronger than it ever was. And the more of this kind of suffering, so long as you hold it all together, the more the suffering, the greater our cohesion. And this is the case in the church, in the parish, monastery, in the guild, and all of these things. It is a Christian version of Rousseau. It is this idea that there is a single general will binding all elements of the Orthodox society together. It is singular, and it is manifest in Logos. Logos is the same thing as wisdom you read about in the Old Testament. Logos is the same thing as essence. In terms of Aristotle's view of essence, it is the sense of energy, and that it is that power, so to speak, that holds the entire organism together. Subordinost is the full general will sustained by the Holy Spirit, bringing everyone together with a singular concept. The only thing that differs is that they have different functions. Bishops, laymen, brotherhoods, priests, wives, by the way, have a great role. Priests' wives are actually very significant in the church, but they don't get very much attention, which I think is an error. We differ only in function. Everything else, we are identical. The one thing that makes Orthodoxy distinct is that grace is something that exists on this earth in its fullness. A hierarchy does not give it to you. They could point to where it is, but that's all they can do. Grace is present. The fullness of the church, the fullness of God's presence in Logos is able to be experienced. But we have to dedicate our lives to this, and there are never any quick fixes. The concept of nationalism for Metropolitan John is Russia as the Third Rome. As Russia building an Orthodox society takes both from the Greek and the Russian Church Fathers as the foundation. Being Russian Orthodox does not mean that you are Russian. It means that you accept the Orthodox tradition as it's been manifest throughout Eastern Europe, in Russia and Ukraine overwhelmingly because they're so much bigger. Taken together, Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, taken together, is about 7/8 of the Orthodox Church. But that's exactly the concept. Russia has this special calling, a special leadership role, and it's been manifested and accepted by the rest of the Orthodox world as the Third Rome. Remember when the Third Rome concept began to develop under Ivan III and Basil III, the idea is all of the Eastern patriarchs accepted the idea that Constantinople has now fallen and that mantle goes to Holy Russia, Moscow. All right, that is the basic view of Metropolitan John. He was a tormentor of the Jewish left throughout Russia and elsewhere. And he is certainly worth your time. If you could find anything in English on him, it would be extremely significant for you, I think. So I appreciate you listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Tuned in to Radio Aryan.